I will talk a little bit about the background of the conference and some of the ideas and the questions that we'll pose. We have a lot more people signed up for this sort of marathon session that will go all this afternoon. We'll try to afford you a little bit of time for breaks in between the panels. And we'll try not to talk too long, all of us, in our appointed sessions. There is a program schedule that I hope that you got when you came in. And there's some slight revisions from the very vertical brochure that you may have had sometime in advance of the symposium. There have been a couple of changes, one that we knew about farther in advance was Ian Coxworth, who was coming from London and couldn't because of the financial crisis. And so we have rearranged the program a little bit, which I think is going to be excellent because it will offer people who have come halfway around the world in order to talk about what they know so well a little bit more time to expose you to those ideas, as well as to have some question and answer interplay. And the structure of the whole conference has been to try to bring together these comparative urbanisms of New York and Hong Kong, and also the network of people, of professionals in the building and design industry, government officials, academics, architects, engineers, in order to talk about how they design and plan and think about their respective cities, and also to exchange how these cities either relate culturally, don't relate, how they get formed, how they take shape. And so with every one of the sessions, we've been trying to illustrate how Hong Kong works and then have a New York response. So the other person who's not going to be able to be with us this afternoon is Sean Donovan, who is going to respond, the Commissioner of Housing Preservation and Development here in New York. And he was going to respond to our first session, which is focusing on vertical communities and housing. And in a few minutes, we'll introduce Nick Brook, who will give that first talk and who's been one of the co-chairs for this whole conference, along with Paul Katz. As soon as Paul arrives, he'll come and say a few words and also introduce Nick. But in any case, in substituting for Sean Donovan is Mark Willis, a very experienced housing expert who worked in the city at HPD and has since been doing community development for almost 20 years now. He happens to be my husband, and he's going to fill in for the discussion. So other than that, he was a late addition to the program. So other than that, you can see the sort of lay of the land in the program that you have here. I'll try to remember, too, to tell you that all of the proceedings are going to be videotaped and audiotaped so that we can present them in a web posting. And the entire conference will be on the Skyscraper Museum's website in an indexed format so that all of the interweaving themes can be explored, and we will have, by the end of the sessions, probably more than 8 or 9 hours worth of discussion on the sort of characters of these two great cities. So what I thought I would do, also thanking the people who have come so far in order, our participants from Hong Kong, to share these ideas and discussions with us, and also to mention that we're very grateful to the MTR. Thomas Ho is here, and he gave an excellent talk yesterday to explain the awesome proportions of the building projects, both infrastructure and commercial space that the Mass Transit Railway Corporation in Hong Kong has created over the last 10 years or so in particular. And so we're very grateful to him for both coming and helping to support the exhibition. And also Jim Robinson from Hong Kong Land has been a great supporter. And we'll be talking about the commercial development in Central tomorrow. But he is, and Hong Kong Land have been especially helpful because they responded to my own sort of initial interest in Hong Kong, in the relationship between Hong Kong and New York, of being Hong Kong being a kind of realization of some of the prophecies of the future city that had characterized New York visionary architecture in the early 20th century. So the premise of this series, follows an arc of three exhibitions that the Skyscraper Museum has been exploring called Future City 2021. The first of these was New York Modern, which was up about six months of about 3 months ago. And in that show, we looked at the idea of New York as the prediction of the city of the future, of the urbanization and modernization process in New York in the early 20th century, and the shift from a market-driven city that was beyond, it seemed to be beyond control, it was just growing by rampant technology, to a shift by architects and public officials, city, not really city planners at the time, but there were urban reformers, who created a zoning law in New York that was passed in 1916, and which established a new psychology about the way the city might grow. And the city took shape by that, and every building that you see in Midtown that has the wedding cake style and the Empire State Building, Jim Connors is here who manages the Empire State Building, that the great characteristic signature towers of New York, like Empire State and Chrysler, follow that template that's created by zoning, by the city management process. So that idea of a rationalized city of towers is kind of the second part of what we're going to explore in this pair of days between this, my PowerPoint here, yesterday's topic of vertical density, learning from Hong Kong, where we took in particular the idea of the global city, of this Time magazine from, actually the Asian edition of Time magazine from January 2008, that looked, as you can see, at this sort of elided global city, a triad of financial capitals of New York, London, and Hong Kong, and posited that they were connected not only by their financial markets, but also by their character as dynamic cities, that they were places that people of power, prestige, wanted to be. They located there for a reason. So these became the winner cities. But winner cities in the world of global capital need to enter the 21st century with the infrastructure and the technology that that serves the communities that drive that business model. And so that we looked yesterday at the MTR's infrastructure of rail and transit, and especially at their transit-based development, and in particular at the two buildings that you see here as the new iconic towers, the one in these images across the harbor, the IFC, International Finance Center, which is the culminating structure of an interconnected commercial network series of towers, a layered city of commerce above train stations, above an airport express. And the building in the foreground, which is the new and as yet unopened but topped out ICC, the International Commerce Center, and its surrounding buildings of Union Square, which is an MTR organized project and which has a number of important developers connected with it. And we talked yesterday with Julia Lau of Sun Hung Kai Properties about the genesis of these projects. So these two skyscraper icons that now are the pylons that mark the entrance to Victoria Harbor are nodes above the Airport Express that bring you from Norman Foster's fantastic airport, probably the most efficient in the world, and best loved by many people, especially business travelers, but which is a sure 23 minutes from entering the one-seat ride carpeted train that is only a few steps away from the gate that you roll your baggage off of as you get off your airplane. And the train comes every 10 or 15 minutes, and 23 minutes later you're in Central, in the very center, the heart of the business district of Hong Kong, where you have a connection to a free bus that takes you to your hotel, or to the subways that take you anywhere else in the city. That kind of dream of transit, of a rationalized transit system for New Yorkers may be many, many years off, but it is the model for the global financial capitals going forward, and it's a necessity, and we talked about that yesterday in general with Lee Sander and Chris Ward, the heads of the MTA, and the Port Authority in New York and New Jersey. There's a view and a cutaway of the KPF and others' design of the base of the ICC tower and the multi-level connections of commercial and transit. and an overview of this new project with its housing. And surrounded by a zone which is yet to be completed, grass here in the rendering, much more elaborate than some of the plans for this West Kowloon Cultural District, which has had one winner in a competition of, I think Foster won the first round of the, maybe not even the first round, but one of the rounds of trying to decide how this new public cultural space would be realized, but ran up against some opposition that we'll discuss in the course of this afternoon's talk, along with this general idea of debating density. So today, we look less at the global city of financial capital and of international business and begin to get down into the problematics of how do cities work, how does density sit on the land, where do people live, what kind of concentrations work with urbanism. And so we're going to ask the question, what does density pay or does it cost? We're going to pose a number of other questions, but just by way of illustrating for those of you who aren't familiar with Hong Kong, a bit of the dynamic skyline, I'll show you a series of views of Hong Kong, in some cases as it's most romantic, but certainly visualizing the incredible, intense compaction of built environment that you see in these characteristic views, looking down, for example, from Victoria Peak past the mid-levels, which is the residential, the high end of residential apartment towers, down into the sort of expanded zone of Central, and to the harbor, of course, because it's the harbors, especially, that New York and Hong Kong share as the genesis for their great identities as first colonial ports that become business capitals. And these views, looking from looking over to the other side of the harbor to Kowloon, where those 70-story tall towers are encircling the Union Square District, or here from the IFC, looking back up the hillside, and so you see the contrast between the dense built environment and the surrounding mountainsides, which of course gives Hong Kong a very different character than New York, as we'll see in some aerial views in a moment, but just to give you a sense of some of the nature of the space, especially these residential districts like the mid-levels, which grew by market forces, essentially. They are controlled by some land management principles, which are much more liberal than those that we have in New York with our own zoning laws, especially the floor area ratio, the FAR. But you see that kind of built density is something that has been created by demand. Now, this the whole conference explores a concept which I don't think is entirely original to the Skyscraper Museum show on vertical cities, but is a distinction which I think is not made often enough, and that is the distinction between different kinds of density. You just saw a market-driven density where people want to occupy and capitalize on the value of that central land. You see that, of course, in Manhattan, and Hong Kong is, in every way, Asia's Manhattan, or as we discussed yesterday, too, maybe the reverse, that New York is becoming becoming the West's Hong Kong. In any case, the two cities are very much alike, and one way that they're alike, notwithstanding the statistics you're seeing here, but looking at the pictures, the density of Midtown and of Manhattan, of throughout Manhattan, is very great. It averages about 70,000 people per square mile, which is exactly the same density if you calculate the built area of Hong Kong. Now I'll show you some images that draw those contrasts out. Of course, we're looking at the heart of Midtown and some of the densest part, but we're seeing in the statistics here a density in kilometers here only of 10,000 people a square kilometer, over, I think it's about 27,000 people square mile that would be. And you see in the same, and these are taken from our exhibition, by the same measure of the boundaries of Hong Kong, of the city boundaries, which are really the special administrative regions boundaries, and the number of people, 7 million people for Hong Kong, 8.25 million people for New York, and Hong Kong is slightly larger in its area than New York City's five boroughs is. If you calculate those densities, Hong Kong seems to have a very low density of only 6,300 a square kilometer as opposed to the 10,000. But the difference is the terrain of Hong Kong and also the land management policies. Whereas you can see in this overall territory of Hong Kong, which includes the islands, various islands, and part of the mainland, is Kowloon being on the north side, and you see the dense built-up area in gray, that is the high-rise development. But you see so much green. The green is the mountainsides. The green is the preserved nature of country parks and also the unbuilt, most of the unbuilt area. That comprises 77% of Hong Kong territory. In New York, if we look at Manhattan from the same distance in the sky, in Google Earth, both of these, this is closer in. In the exhibition, you're seeing a portion of Hong Kong in the same distance in the sky. But in order to be able to see some detail in New York, you can see some areas that are sort of green. We cut off below Central Park, but you can see Union Square and various squares that are slightly gray-green color. But what you see very clearly is there is no strong contrast between the nature space and the built environment. So Hong Kong's built environment, on less than a quarter of its 426 square miles, means there's 100 square miles of built area, 7 million people, 70,000 people per square mile, even counting those new towns. So that all the people of Hong Kong live at the same density as Manhattan. And if we contrast the kind of density that you see, which is not vertical density, but horizontal density, and you take the world's largest cities like Cairo and Mumbai, you can see that Cairo, with its 37 square kilometers, 37,000 people, or Mumbai with 21,000 people, are vastly more dense statistically than Hong Kong or New York, but you need only to look at the nature of their skyline to see that it's a different kind of density. In fact, it's a density of congestion, of crowding, as it happens with these cities too, a density of poverty rather than of affluence. So we want to ask the question, what is the relationship between a vertical density, which happens to correlate with the vertical cities of Hong Kong and New York, and the kind of density which is what we usually talk about, people usually talk about, not me, but people usually talk about density as a bad thing, as a dirty word, as something to be avoided. And so that is debating of density, we wanted to deepen the discussion of over these 3 days. London, it chooses to be a lower rise city, and we can see that it's very low density indeed if you take its boundaries. So the discussion this afternoon will focus on first housing and how that works. Nick Brooks' paper will talk about vertical communities. It works in Hong Kong. And so I'm just showing you a few images of those to get you in the mood and familiarize you. Still that line of the mountains and the nature space in strong contrast to the 40, 50, and 60 story towers, most of which you're seeing in these photographs of Sun Kwan Oh, privately built middle class housing built for profit indeed quite profitable. And with identical towers rising above a podium base of shopping and direct rail transit. Just to show you a little variety of that and get in a little closer with the different views. These are about 52 or 54 story towers in Sun Kwan Oh. You're in Tung Chung, a new town that was created to serve the airport community, the new airport in Lantau. These are new communities, indeed mini cities. And if we think of them, in a moment. So the difference between horizontal density and vertical density is great. The similarity between New York and Hong Kong, in the competition for space and the kind of density of market-driven density that you see in a slide like this, looking towards Central, is characteristic of both Manhattan and Hong Kong. But there's also a designing density, an intentional density, that is a different kind. But it is dense. It's a vertical density, but in the, what we will look at next in Nick Brooks' illuminating talk are the dynamics that create, by decision, the kind of density that makes the strong line between the nature space of the hills and the concentration of the 50 and 60 story towers of middle class housing. Different than the way we've done it in the States. Co-op City is the top view. Taikoo Shing is the lower view. That was one of the earliest housing estates built in the late 1970s, and it's about four or five times as dense. I think it's 138 people per acre Co-op City, 755 an acre for Taikoo Shing. So we will look to then in the next series of talks by Peter Cookson Smith and Christine Lowe and then Maggie Brook at the issues of harbor and heritage of urban space and connectivity. And this slide sort of poses the question a little bit in the foreground about the questions of landfill and the harbor, the reclamation, and how that space is used. And we're going to discuss that as well as the nature and the character of streets, how they work, streets and neighborhoods. And then I think, yes, and that black, this black slide represents both the more traditional streetscape and the people crowding the streets that didn't transfer from Flickr into my PowerPoint for some reason. So those don't exist, even though they exist on my computer, they don't exist here. And we'll go back to that one as evoking some of the character of the separated streets, the streets in the air, that we'll talk a lot more about in the architect's talks and the theory and practice that is tomorrow's session. So is Paul here?
Yeah.
There he is. Come on up.